Ms. Fye, good morning to you. You may approach. And Mr. Lewis, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Then, Ms. Fye, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tana Fye, and I was court-appointed to represent the appellant, Ms. Amanda Applehans, on appeal. Ms. Applehans is a woman with serious mental health issues which were known to all legal counsel and to the district court during the pendency of her entire case. She came to the district court's attention after she was arrested at a Target in Kearney, Nebraska. She was arrested on a myriad of charges after pretending to be a cowgirl on the concrete barriers outside of the store, waving at and bothering customers, refusing to leave the store, and ultimately assaulting store staff and law enforcement. In this matter, while represented by Lydia Davis, formerly of the Buffalo County Public Defender's Office, Ms. Applehans ultimately entered a plea of no contest to third-degree assault on an officer and third-degree assault and was found guilty. Once bound over to the district court, Ms. Applehans initially had entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. At that same hearing, she was improperly advised of the penalties by the district court judge. No motion for competency or psychological evaluation was filed before that plea was entered, and no evaluation was completed before that plea was entered.
I'm not reading your brief as challenging anything with respect to the voluntariness or the entry of the plea. Did I miss something?
No, Your Honor. Ultimately, the issues that I raise are relating to Ms. Applehans' mental situation and the ineffective assistance of counsel that was provided to her, that didn't take into consideration those particular mental health issues. I'm also raising the issue of the bond and how combined the bond factors as required by Section 29-901, Subsection 1, not being considered by the district court ultimately resulted in Ms. Applehans remaining in custody pretrial for 106 days.
Let's back up a step on the ineffective assistance of counsel. In your assignment of error, I do not see any specificity whatsoever regarding the purported deficient conduct of prior counsel. You are familiar with our jurisprudence on the requirement of specificity, are you not?
I am, Your Honor. And in preparing for this oral argument and further reviewing the case law and the briefs in this matter, I do understand that it is possible that the court may view my brief as having been incorrectly briefed due to using just a single assignment of error with numbered assignments or numbered grounds within that assignment of error. I would note for the court that
there aren't any numbered grounds within the assignment of error section. You're now talking about the argument section, aren't you?
I'm talking, yes, about the argument section where I numbered the specific bases for the ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
But you're familiar with the cases that require the specificity of assignments of error in the assignments of error section.
I am, Your Honor, and I believe that substantively what was briefed in this matter does comply with the expectations from previous case law, wherein the specific allegations have to be made about what conduct was deficient in order to allow this court to determine whether those claims can be decided upon the trial record, as well as to allow a district court later on a post-conviction relief case to determine what issues were brought before the appellate court.
If this court were to read all of this together in your brief, this is a follow-up to Justice Castle's observation about the format of the briefing. Is this what's on your mind, that there was no acknowledgement of receipt of the post-release supervision plan terms, and that it was ineffective of counsel not to make a note of it at that time? Is that what you want us to consider?
Your Honor, I think that there were a number of reasons why counsel was ineffective. Not ensuring that any sort of advisement was made either by the district court at the time of sentencing regarding post-release supervision, or ensuring that probation later made such an advisement and that a copy acknowledging that advisement was provided back to the district court. That is a basis.
Was there a waiver of the pre-sentence report?
There was a waiver of the pre-sentence investigation on the record at the time of the hearing. I believe ultimately that the reason that that was done, as Ms. Appelhahn stated repeatedly in the record, was that she ultimately wanted out of jail and believed that by entering a plea and proceeding immediately to sentencing without any evidence, that was her ticket to get out of jail.
So if we were to reach the merits, that's what's on your mind?
So ultimately, yes. With respect to the post-release supervision, I think that although there's case law that's clear that the court doesn't have to advise a defendant of all of the specific items of post-release supervision with which they may have to comply, and a general advisement that the standard terms of post-release supervision would apply, I'm aware of that particular case law. But when the post-release supervision form that was developed specifically lists a place where the defendant is supposed to sign that they've received a copy of it and are aware of their requirements, when that wasn't done in this case, I think that that does present a particular error.
Doesn't that form have the bar number as well? Doesn't it contemplate that perhaps it's the lawyer that might sign that?
I think that the form does contemplate that the lawyer may be the one that does that advisement.
And in this instance, doesn't the record show that this order of post-release supervision was served on her then counsel?
So, Your Honor, I'm going to speak from a place of being trial counsel who regularly handles criminal cases and sentencing matters. It would be uncommon from a practice perspective to expect an attorney to sit down and advise a defendant of all of the specifics of a probationary sentence of a post-release supervision sentence.
Is it unreasonable to expect a lawyer to provide a copy of an order to the defendant?
I think that it's perfectly reasonable to expect a lawyer to provide a copy to their client.
And does the record reflect that that was not done in this case?
Based on there being no documentation in the record, I would submit that it shows that that was not ever done.
You're arguing that a silent record establishes that it wasn't done, but don't we have a presumption of regularity that applies certainly with respect to court officials and perhaps to counsel in their capacity as officers of the court, that they will perform the duty that they're obligated to do? How do we get to this from a silent record?
Well, I think that, I'm going to return to the form itself, where it contemplates that that would be signed and then filed with the district court, and that's being standard procedure with either a probation order or a post-release supervision order. That wasn't done would indicate that Ms. Appelhahn wasn't actually advised of the obligations that she had by the probation office, by her counsel, by the court, by anyone.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
What's the remedy that you're asking for in this appeal? That we send it back and the post-release supervision advisement is given?
So I believe that in the appellee brief, there was a note that even the state recognizes that this post-release supervision form should be signed by the defendant. If the court finds that that was there, I think that the remedy for that particular piece of it would be sending it back for essentially resentencing or...
Why would there be a need for resentencing if the only problem was the signing of this form, we're just sending it back for the form to be signed?
I think if the court finds error solely on this piece, it needs to be sent back in order for her to be advised of the requirements of post-release supervision, either by the district court or by the probation office, with that form then signed. If the court finds that the other issues that I raised in my brief are with merit, then I think that ultimately what the case needs to be sent back for would be a new trial.
What's the relief for the bond issue? Is that moot at this point?
So the states argue that that's moot. I believe that that's tied up with the particular issues that I outlined in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. If we have somebody who's sitting in jail, who's mentally ill, they don't receive the proper remedies at the district court level, I think that the remedy is we send it back for a new trial so that all of those additional things that should have been done in this case, like the full psychological evaluation, like a ruling on the competency determination, can occur, and then she can make informed decisions about how she wants to proceed with the case. I would note that the court never ruled on the issue of competency here. So
before your time completely expires, you raised an excessive sentence claim, but as I read your brief, you have not challenged any of the specific conditions of post-release supervision that were imposed by the court and that appear in the order that's in our record. Am I correct about that?
So, Your Honor, with respect to the excessive sentence, the district court was required to consider all of the factors from State versus Timmons. The district court never indicated that it had considered any of those factors or all of those factors as are required by case law. The district court didn't take any evidence whatsoever.
You're suggesting that our case law requires a district court to pronounce its specific findings about the individual factors? Is that your position?
Not specifics regarding what their findings are on those factors, but simply that they have considered the factors that they're required to do. That's standard practice for sentencing hearings in our county and district courts across the state. The district court did not do that in this case. The State versus Decker specifically states that an abuse of discretion takes place when the sentencing court's reasons or rulings are clearly untenable. I would submit that in this case, the rulings are untenable because we have absolutely no basis to establish that they are tenable. We don't know what the court considered. There were documents that purportedly may have been reviewed by counsel and by the judge, but they were never received into evidence. We have absolutely no basis to determine what the judge was looking at when determining that the sentence here should be imposed.
You would agree that the sentences, both as to imprisonment and post-release supervision, were within statutory limits?
I would stipulate that they were within the guidelines.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lewis, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is Ms. Applehahn's direct appeal related to her plea-based convictions for third-degree assault of an officer, a Class 3A felony, and third-degree assault, a Class 1 misdemeanor. She assigned several errors that her trial counsel was ineffective, that the district court erred by denying her bond modification request prior to her pleas, and that the district court erred by not providing a detailed pronouncement of her post-release supervision terms, and then finally, that the district court ordered excessive sentences. I'll start off in order unless there's a certain order that the court would like me to take this.
This might be the order in which you're proceeding, but we did have some questions about the application of 29.2204.027, advise the offender on the record the time the offender will serve on his or her term and so forth.
Yeah.
Is that relevant to this case? Was it done and is it relevant given the assignments of error or lack thereof?
I think that it is relevant given the assignment that essentially that the court was deficient for not providing those specific terms on the record to Ms. Applehans. I think that that statute, while not necessarily addressing what doesn't need to be a part of the pronouncement, it does say what should be a part of that pronouncement.
Did the court tell the defendant how long a term of post-release supervision?
Both verbally and also in the written order. Now, the specific terms that are included as part of that pronouncement, it just says standard terms and conditions, which I realize is there's a parallel to draw here between this case in State v. Hartzell, 309 Nebraska 82 in 2019. And this court provided an acknowledgement, and that was in a probation term where there was also not a lengthy pronouncement of the specific details of probation. And this court provided that the practice of entering separate sentencing and probation orders is disapproved. Instead, a sentencing court should enter its entire judgment, including all of the terms and conditions of probation at one time. We remind trial courts that when imposing a sentence, the court should state with the care of the precise terms of the sentence which is imposed.
The written order complied with that, didn't it?
The written order complies with that, and it is filed nearly contemporaneously. I think it's either on the same day, it's dated the same day, and it might be filed the next day or something along those lines. But certainly the terms and conditions are provided in a separate post-release supervision order that goes out written to the parties, ostensibly to opposing counsel, trial counsel. And then also you have a written sentencing order which includes time incarceration and then time on post-release supervision into what counts that applies.
I heard that the appellant is not challenging the terms of post, or the conditions of post-release supervision.
Correct.
At least hasn't been asserted. So aren't we talking about, to the extent there's a defect at all, isn't it a technical defect? And wouldn't the sending it back be sort of an exercise of go back and read the same thing that's already in the record?
Right, and that is essentially the state's position, not necessarily that it's an exercise in futility, but if you know, given sort of the provisions in Hartzell, and if you wanted to take it a step further, if you wanted to say that, you know, a trial court would be, or sentencing court would be best served, and everyone would be best served, and as a matter of transparency, and as a matter of making sure that everybody knows exactly what they're supposed to do, if this court wanted to send it back so that Ms. Appelhans can be brought into court and it can be read, or at least the court can provide her the sheet and say, have you read it? Do you have any problems with it? Do you acknowledge these terms? I mean, I can't see a world in which that is. I mean, it's extra work, to be clear.
Is it required by statute?
No. In the state, you know, that's sort of my frontline argument.
So why should we be making it up?
I'm not saying that the court should make it up. I just, I'm trying to allow, or I guess I'm trying to take into account if there wanted to be that extra little bit of effort.
If it were required, or at least advisable, wherever we find ourselves, forgive me for my lack of familiarity with the sentencing hearing, what we have said in the Dyer case in 2017, where there was a statute that said the court's supposed to provide reasoning, and we wrote, at least the per curiam opinion wrote, that the checklist of reasons combined with the comments at the sentencing was sufficient. Is that a viable outcome here? Whether or not something was signed, the dialogue and the advisements and the proceedings add up to sufficient.
Right, and ultimately, I think in my brief, and the points that I make in my brief, is what happened here is sufficient. I don't think that there's a need. I don't think that there is a call by statute or case law to send this back to bring Ms. Appelhans in. And to be clear, I think from the appellant's brief, the ask is, you know, it kind of leads us up to the water and doesn't say exactly, you know, what needs to happen next. I think that what was just suggested here is that there's a remand and the whole thing is done over again. But I don't think that there's anything wrong with what happened. However, if this court wanted to take it a couple extra steps and say, you know, like, okay, fine, here are the terms. Do you have any problems with that? And I think that this case isn't, that isn't necessarily on display, you know, Ms. Appelhans' problem with the post-release supervision part, because, again, there isn't the challenge of, you know, and also I have problems with these terms. I've never acknowledged any sort of receipt of these things, but, you know, now that I have it in front of me, I have a problem with these things and I'm not interested in complying with them. And if I would have known these things to begin with, I would have moved to withdraw my plea or something like that. But to be clear, I think that what happened on the record was sufficient. And that is the frontline position of the state's brief on this point.
The terms are included in our record, correct?
Yes.
So if there had been any question or challenge to those terms, they could have been brought as part of this appeal?
Yes.
So this is not similar to the situation where the appellant would have violated a term of which he had no notice of.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes. If there are no further questions on the post-release supervision portion, I'll move on. Starting in order with the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims, the main line position of the state's brief here is that this doesn't comply with MERS and the follow-on cases like Drake that require specificity in the assignment of error. Regardless of that, the state would just submit that the plea hearing does not support the claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. There's a valid entry of pleas. There's a colloquy back and forth with the court that this is what Ms. Appelhans wants to do. There's an expressed desire by Ms. Appelhans to continue with her trial counsel despite you know, manifestations of prior reservations about being represented by the public defender's office in Buffalo County and sort of her overall desire to get out of court. All that stuff is on the record. Her mental health status, all that stuff is on the record. And I would just say that I would first rely on MRSA and Drake and second wise, just say that, you know, the record doesn't support much or all of those. Moving on to the bond modification denial, state believes that this issue is moot. Case law cited in the state's brief offers that bond remedies are generally not available after conviction and sentencing. State v. Thomas via Cheney v. Ebnin central question in a mootness analysis is whether changes in circumstances have forestalled any occasion for meaningful relief. I think that that's quite on display here. I mean, we've moved on past the plea stage, convictions entered, sentences entered. I'm not sure what sort of remedy can be offered here. And I think that the appellant's brief sort of makes that clear because, again, it's one of these situations where it walks us up to the water's edge, but I'm not sure what we do with it now that we have it. And then finally, if there are no questions on any of that, the excessive sentence claims, I would just rely on the points raised in my brief for the most part. I think that the district court demonstrated a familiarity with the facts of the case, the progression of the case, Ms. Appelhans's individual factors. There's no indication that there's coercion or promises outside of the plea agreement on the record. Again, she waived the pre-sentence investigation report, which the district court could have used to consider those things further. District court talks on the record about, you know, what it's thinking when it sentences her. So, there are no further questions. The state would just submit on its briefs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No. Yeah.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Appelhans. So thank you very much. And Ms. Fye, thank you for your service. And the next case of the day is State versus Buell.